League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 30th of April, 2020. On the podcast today, Tony Menini, Executive Chairman of Asia Met Resources. And Tony provides an operational and corporate update and also discusses the outlook for copper. Also on the podcast, Neil Ricketts, Chief Executive Officer of Vesarion. Neil explains the significance of the grant awarded to its subsidiary, 2D Tech, from Advanced Propulsion Center. Plus, Nick Lee, Director of Piraeus Investments, talks through some of the highlights from their final results and also gives an overview into some of their investments. And I have Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com, covers news from Shell, Lloyds, and Reckitt Benckiser.
To receive free company updates straight to the front screen of your smartphone whenever a company you follow releases significant news, download the free Vox Markets app from voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Tony Menini, Executive Chairman of Asia Met Resources, ARS's ticker. Tony, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, great to be here, Justin. It's been a while since we've caught up, and looking forward to having a chat.
Yeah, how the world has changed. Like you said just then, you haven't... How long since you've been at home that long?
I've actually been home for 7 weeks, which is the longest period that I haven't travelled for 25 years. So my wife and children are just getting used to me being home, and I'm starting to get used to being at home. So all good.
I like that. That's now, you know, it was abnormal to have you home. Who's this strange fella? Why is he hanging around so often? Oh, it's Dad. Yeah. Oh, brilliant. Cool. It's my husband. Marvellous. Yeah. That's good. Yeah,
yeah, the world stopped calling me uncle, and now they're calling me dad.
Yeah, I thought you were uncle Tony. No, your father. Oh, okay. Marvelous stuff. Okay, well, listen, we're going to dig in, and I think we'll break it down into you know, operational, corporate, and maybe look at the copper as well, see how that's doing. But before we do, as always, Tony, just a brief summary for people who are listening right now, the first time ever, and thought, what did Asia Met do? Could you just briefly explain it, please?
Yeah, Asia Met's, Justin, is an AIM-listed company with a focus on copper development in Asia, in particular Indonesia. We've got two core projects which are part of a large copper-gold portfolio. Those two projects are BKM. BKM has been drilled up. It's been through full feasibility study. It has a very robust very robust economics defined by feasibility and is ready to take forward and into development for a 25,000-ton SX solvent extraction electrowinning copper project producing copper metal. The second project is Butong, very large porphyry copper gold. It's been drilled up 33,000 metres of drilling. It's got very large JORC compliant resources. It's very well located near the coast and existing infrastructure. So, you know, two great assets, one development ready and one big further development opportunity coming down the pipeline, all, you know, fantastically located right near the main consumer markets in Asia. That's the asset side. The team, you've got a very experienced team. We've been involved in copper gold mine developments over the past 35 years. Myself been involved in, you know, around 10 different developments over that period of time and continue to do so today. So very experienced team. We've done it all before. You know, we've been through the ups and downs and cyclicity of the business. And, you know, we're really here for, you know, a serious value creation exercise by taking these assets through to development and into production. So that's Asia Met in a snapshot, Justin.
Yeah, okay. Well, before we get into operation, let's talk about it. Someone's thinking, okay, so copper. Why is copper relevant and what's the profile here? What's going to happen to copper, do you think?
Yeah, look, it's a question I pretty much get asked most days at the moment. Copper is in a bit of a weak period, impacted, of course, by, economic slowdown related to COVID. Copper's a very large, it's the largest base metals market on the globe. It's around sort of three times the size of the next, biggest metals market. Being zinc, copper is used in pretty much sort of everything, really. Most people will be aware, pipes, electrification, and more in, green energy, electric vehicles, etc. I think one of the key things where, we are in a bit of short-term weakness here, and there's sort of two sides to the equation with respect to copper at the moment, Justin. There's the side which is the demand dropping away because of the short-term hit to, the economy, which everybody's aware of. So demand sort of dropping in particular. I mean, China's the largest consumer in the world, consumes about 50% of global copper. It's just coming out of that now, and we're seeing sort of the activity there starting to pick up. We've got other places in the world, other consuming areas, still weak. So... But one of the key sort of thematics, I think, here is that, while there's been a demand hit in the near term, there's also been a significant supply hit. So, we've got a lot of mines, particularly, in Peru, for example, which is the second largest copper producer in the world. We've got a lot of the largest, some of the biggest mines actually effectively in lockdown on care and maintenance at the moment, or significantly reduced production levels. That's just in Peru, and there's, other examples in various other places. So we've got a hit to the supply side as well. So while we've got, weak demand, we've got a hit on the supply side. What I think is very interesting is that, all the major players in copper are still very actively looking for new projects. There was a deal, I think, announced a couple of days ago where Rio Tinto is farming into, a project in Zambia and spending, a very significant amount of money on exploration for copper in Zambia. So there's just one example, and there's many examples like that where the bigger players are positioning in copper during this sort of period of weakness, because the long-term fundamentals are very, very strong, and they remain very strong. And it's interesting that none of the brokers, when you look at the brokers' forecasts, they've got short-term, it's also the brokers, you've got CRU, you've got AME, you've got Wood Mackenzie, all the independent forecasters. When you look at all their numbers, all the different groups, have copper a bit weak in the short term, but they have not adjusted their long-term prices. So they're still keeping their long-term pricing at $3 or above, depending on which group, whose data you're looking at. But they still see, fundamentally copper, the supply-demand equation, being... the supply side being restricted longer term and fundamentally stronger prices. So if you sort of think about what happens, as we come out of COVID, there's a huge, you can see the amount of money going into economic stimulus packages globally. And I think, one of the key focuses of countries to stimulate economies is going to be on modernization of their infrastructure. And, copper... is a big part of infrastructure development. It's a big part of industrialization and urbanization globally. And I think, we will see copper demand benefit from the focus on modernization of infrastructure, which creates jobs, which, drives economic a pickup in economies. So the US has already alluded to that, huge stimulus package going to, modernization of its infrastructure. And, certainly there'll be other places looking to do the same. And that's that's over and above, you know, the demand from, you know, the growing developing world, you know, particularly driven by Asia, which, you know, we're already seeing, you know, parts of it, particularly China, starting to pick up, as I said. So, look, I think, you know, while we've got a little bit of short-term weakness, the fundamentals remain very strong, and, you know, we're very bullish on copper. I think COVID, in some ways, has reset the clock a bit. It's probably given people the opportunity to get set, given them a bit more time to get set than they otherwise would have had before. But, you know, the same fundamentals will play out. We've probably got a, you know, we've probably got a delay, you know, of, you know, probably call it sort of 6 to 12 months. But, you know, fundamentally, you know, copper's in a good space.
Yeah, yeah, and you've always said, you know, it's a cyclical business. You know, the weak times are the good times, pretty much, to look around for to start investing and developing, and then before the boom happens, really, isn't it?
Yeah, look, no, it's always, you know, you've just touched on it. I mean, it's a cyclical business. You know, we all understand it's a cyclical business. It goes up and it has its ups and downs, but. You know, the fundamentally, in a cyclical business, you need to be counter-cyclical. And, you know, as I said, this sort of bit of weakness that we're getting. And look, the weakness, you know, we talk about weakness. You know, copper came back to $2 and it strengthened back up to around $2.30, and, you know, it's starting to creep up again. So it's not like it's fallen in a big hole. It's pulled back a bit, and, you know, it'll start to pick up. So I think, you know, to your point, Justin, you know, that reset gives investors an opportunity to, you know, to look at copper opportunities like AsiaMet, get themselves set. And, you know, for a company like us, the best time to develop is in periods like this. You've got availability of, you know, you've got availability of labor, you've got availability of materials, you know, you've got the things that you need when things are weak. It's not, you know, when you're in a bull market, you know, it's very hard to get consultants, contractors, labor, materials, and you're paying, you know, more than full prices for them. So, you know, you get set now, you get yourself ready, and, you know, hopefully bring on your production as the prices start to move up. And that's, you know, that's where we've really set ourselves. And, you know, I've sort of been, I guess, having a discussion like this with you for quite a period of time, Justin. We started this out in 2015. We sort of went through the feasibility study with BKM. We're ready to press the button. We've had a period of weakness. And, you know, we've sort of had to ride out that period of weakness. We feel that sort of we're coming through that now. As you'll be aware, we've recently done a financing and a deal with a partner to take the project forward. So for us, you know, it's really a reset, and you know, driven by the fundamentals of the market more than anything else. And, you know, we're ready to sort of continue to move forward and be prepared to, you know, get ourselves sort of up the curve and ready for into production by the time sort of the market turns, you know.
Yes. Well, talking about, you know, on the corporate a second, talking about that, so is it Aeternum, is how you pronounce it, but they got a good price, didn't they?
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, it's an interesting thing. Everybody had the opportunity to buy at that price at that time. And, you know, to Aeternum's credit, they stepped up to the plate, you know, in a very difficult time. And look, you know, I think the other thing that I think is worth mentioning as well, Justin, is that not only did Aeternum step up, I mean, it's easy to look back now and say, well, you know, they got a good price and a good entry. But, you know, at the time that the deal was done, the market was falling dramatically. Every day, the copper price was falling. You know, the world was coming to an end as far as all investors were concerned.
That's it, isn't it? Do you know what, Tony? You're right there. I mean, it's. Do you know what? That phrase, buy low, sell high, everyone knows that phrase. But when it comes down to it and you've got money in the market's dropping off a cliff, it's a lot harder to press that buy button when everyone's screaming, and running for the doors, isn't it, you know?
Absolutely, Justin. Absolutely. And look, you know, there's a book called Mastering the Market Cycle by Howard Marks. He's the founder of Oak Tree Capital Management. Yeah. If you read that book, it's probably got everything you ever need to know about investing in it. But one of the things that, you know, I took away from that book is investing is very simple. Everyone knows what you need to do, but human emotion makes it very difficult to execute.
Yeah.
And you know, it's only the good investors, the best investors, I should say, are the ones who are able to execute when everyone else is running for the hills. So, you know, Aeternum, to their credit, as I say, stepped up. And a key point I want to make is that let's not forget myself and some of the other directors and some sort of key long-term shareholders also stepped up at that very difficult time. So, you know, it's we fundamentally understood what the value equation was. You know, we were in a position to be able to act, and did so, and put our money where our mouth is. You know, when the chips were down. So look, back to Aeternum. You know, to their credit, they stepped up. They did get a good deal. At the end of quite a long process where we've been working to secure a funding partner for long-term development of the BKM project. We've sort of been in a process for probably 12 months, nothing unusual about that. We had, you know, a wide range of groups have a look. You know, a number of them fell by the wayside for various reasons. And I will say, and I've said this before, you know, nothing to do with the quality of the project or the work, more to do with, you know, various aspects of their own businesses and, you know, where they are at. So some are coal producers, you know, and the coal market's been poor and, you know, various other sort of aspects along the way. But we got down to, you know, we had three groups, you know, who were doing some serious DD, who had done some serious DD, I should say, when COVID hit. And, you know, unfortunately, when COVID hit, it was just impossible to execute a deal. You couldn't travel. Companies were fearful of what was going to happen with their own businesses, and everybody went into sort of, you know, which is preserving their own, ensuring their, you know, the survival of their own businesses, because it was looking, you know, looked pretty dour there every day for a period of time. We got caught in a pincer movement, if you like, where, you know, we were pushing to get a deal. We were short on capital because we were very close to getting a deal, and we felt that we didn't need to be raising capital at that time. But, you know, ultimately, as I said, Aeternum stepped up and, you know, did a placement, got 60 days to do diligence, and we're about halfway through that diligence period now. So, you know, it's a Singapore-based group, Aeternum. They are a commodities trader, particularly in oil, and, you know, they trade coal and other minerals, and, you know, they're looking to sort of continue to develop out their business, whereby they've got investments in mining, so they've got a supply of product to trade, and they're looking to continue building out a mining services business to service the production assets which produce, you know, commodities to trade. So it's sort of a fully integrated business that, you know, they're working and building on. And, you know, the green energy thematic that copper represents is particularly attractive to them. They see fundamentally that that's will become a bigger and bigger part of the focus in the commodity space, and, you know, copper is obviously an important part of that, related to you know, EVs and green energy, which are becoming, you know, renewables, which are becoming more and more predominant. So, we're working closely with them now, and as I said, about 3 weeks into the diligence period.
Yeah, no, you've got to give it to them. They've stepped up, and let's be honest, that is March the 23rd was the big down day, the final down day, and they got a decent price. As the, you know, as yourself, Tony, it's a 3x return on that already, so you can see how oversold it was. Just the bounce back is phenomenal. Okay, let's move on to operations. Just take us through, say, next within the next 6 months, 12 months, what are you hoping to achieve there, Tony?
Yeah, so, look, one of the... I guess there's many things that we're working on, Justin, and I sort of break them down into two or three key areas. So the first area is the permitting for the project construction. So, you know, we've got a team, Indonesian team, in-country, you know, working on various permits, and they're really sub-permits which feed into what's called the Pinjimpukai, which is the Forestry Borrow and Use Permit, which is the major permit that you need to essentially move to construction. Now, every mining project anywhere in the world has multiple permits that they need to get and renew on an annual basis. We have been through a lot of those, and this is the sort of last major permit that we need. So we've got the team working on that. There's a whole lot of different aspects that feed into that, and you know, that's continuing to happen in the background and going, you know, going along well. And despite the sort of COVID downturn, you know, we're able to continue moving all of that along nicely, you know, working from home along across the wires, and you know, the government is still, you know, functioning, you know, well in that respect. So all of that's happening. The de-risking related to the permitting and the permitting for the development. So the second piece is the value engineering side. So there's from the feasibility study, mm-hmm. we identified sort of two key areas, if you like, Justin, where, you know, we've got an NPV of $125 million on the project now. It's a good, solid, robust project, mm-hmm. but, you know, we have identified some key areas where we can, you know, further enhance the economics, you know, pretty significantly actually from where they are today. And look, this is a typical, you know, it's a typical profile of a development asset. So what we're doing is, you know, there's sort of two key areas to that. As I said, the first key area is, you know, some of the value engineering. So looking, you know, looking to at various aspects of the processing, the mining, the power in particular, and, you know, getting optimum, you know, better outcomes from those will, you know, potentially add, you know, somewhere in the order of, you know, $35 to $50 million of sort of value enhancements. If they all came off, they won't all come off, but that's the sort of target that's in there. There's, you know, that sort of $30 to $50 million of MPV in value engineering. We're doing selective parts of that, Justin. We haven't pushed that ahead fully because there's some, you know, significant amounts of capital involved in that, and obviously, you know, we've raised some money and we're, you know, in good solid shape right now, but we've still got to be, you know, we've got to manage our funding well until the point where we've secured, you know, a long-term sort of solution for the funding of the project, and that's, you know, where we're in discussions with Aeternum right now. So, you know, in 3 weeks' time, yeah, that may be somewhere where we say, okay, we've got a deal done with Aeternum, or not 3 weeks, but it'll be, you know, three weeks and a bit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we've got a deal done, we've got funding, and let's push ahead now and do all the value engineering, right? We can actually open up the throttle and just go flat out at it. Yeah. But, you know, we are still in a... You know, this is, we got to recognize where we are. You know, we're still, it's, I mean, the things are still pretty tight, and the market's still, fairly shaky. So we've just, we're doing bits and pieces that, we think are sensible to do with the funding that we've currently got. The second major piece is really around the mine life. So we've currently got a 9-year mine life on BKM. Huge potential to expand, that 9-year mine life. We've got, four or five immediate targets, around. And for, if we can add, 3 to 4 years of mine life to BKM, which I'm very confident we can do, it's going to add, potentially up to, $50 to $100 million of additional NPV. So, that's obviously, a big priority. We haven't been in a position to be able to be drilling for quite a while. And obviously we've got a bit of a period that we've still got to wait because of the, the COVID impacts where we can get going. But, as soon as we can hit the ground, we've got rigs running ready, we've got people ready, and it's, it's easy access and we can get up and running quickly when we can do that. So, look, we've got, 3 or 4 key targets. We've got the link zone between, the BKM and the BKZ. And I just, Justin, just to remind people, the BKZ is not included in any of the economics that we've done so far, right? Yeah. The BKZ, we drilled 3 months of drilling. With 3 months of drilling back, it's now about 18 months ago. In 3 months, we put together 1.5 million tons of very high grade, at surface, high value polymetallic mineralization. Now, we've been wanting to do a lot more drilling, get back in there and potentially sort of get, we think there's 5 to 10 million tons potential of that type of stuff in the BKM area, not just in the link zone, but there's a few other targets that look very similar around the BKM area where we can pull together that sort of tonnage. Now, to put that in perspective, if you look at Adriatic Minerals, which is a Aussie, and I think it's a dual listed company actually, it's got a market cap I think of around $200 to $250 million, with a polymetallic, a nice, very nice polymetallic project in Bosnia Herzegovina. Our grades there at BKZ are very much the same as they've got. They've got around 10 million tons. We've got around 1.5 million tons. And I think that just gives you some perspective of what the potential is with that polymetallic stuff at BKZ. If we can grow that inventory, there's a lot of value sort of sitting there, and it's at surface. It's not down deep. It's actually at surface. So that's, one key target. We've got, open-ended copper hits below BKM. We've got multiple geophysical targets at BK, just immediately beneath and to the west of BKM, BK West also. We've got copper at surface. We've got IP targets at depth, and, we need to get and drill those. We've been wanting to do that for a long time. And BK South, we've already got some, really nice hits, and people can see those sort of on the website. We've only drilled a small number of holes, and almost every hole's got mineralization, and probably 4 out of 6 holes, I think it is, got economic mineralization from surface. So a lot of upside there, and that's where, as soon as we can get on the ground, we're going to start to drill some of those key targets, try to look to add additional life, demonstrate the upside potential that I think is being missed by the market and a lot of people, demonstrate that sort of huge upside potential that's there, convert some of those resources to additional mine life, which will flow directly into sort of enhanced NPV. So that's sort of the two key focus areas. Obviously on the corporate side, we're working hard on the deal, and we can come back to that in a minute. The other aspect is, of course, that we've got Bootong there. Bootong's sort of been, on hold during this difficult period, and we've focused, all our attention really on BKM. But, Bootong, it's a sleeping giant, It's a big tonnage, good grade, copper-gold deposit, with good infrastructure nearby, and it's right on the doorstep of the main consumer market. It's drilled up to JORC standard. It's still open in multiple directions. It's got a very sweet high-grade core, a couple of hundred million tonnes from the surface of high-grade copper gold, and, you know, a really big, strong mag target at depth that needs to be tested with some deep holes. We'll look to advance Bootong, in partnership with somebody else while we're sort of focused on the development of BKM. And we have had quite a lot of interest in that. And again, that's been slowed down a bit by this sort of current, COVID crisis and lockdown. But, you know, we'll revisit some of that once we come through this. And, you know, there is, as I said, there is, you know, definitively ongoing interest in copper projects. We'll see renewed interest or renewed sort of activity in terms of reviewing Bootong as we sort of move out of this period. I've no doubt about that. So, you know, one of the a couple of other things we've been looking at, Justin. Yeah. You know, there's a near surface, oxide copper. So we're looking at, potentially whether we can start that as a smaller project, a heap leach like BKM, and then gradually scale it up. And the other thing that, probably many people are not aware, there's about a quarter of a million ounces of, oxide gold at surface on top of the BK West deposit, which potentially is heap leachable. So, there's a few things to look at there in terms of, starter projects to get those that particular Bootong project sort of further advanced. But, we can only at this time, our focus is predominantly on getting, BKM up and running. So a lot of activity there, Justin. At the moment it's really, the really pushing forward the permitting, the de-risking, and a few of the aspects of the value engineering, and then as soon as we can get on the ground, it'll be drilling to enhance value there, and we'll continue working on the corporate end with Aeternum and others.
Marvellous stuff, Tony. It's an excellent update, and like I said, lots of options and lots of potential. But like everything, it's been at the moment, the market's ground to a halt, isn't it, with COVID-19, but that will pass, and it'll be when we, as always with these kind of things, I think, when you, from an investment point of view, of course, when you look back on these periods in time, it's a blip in the market. And at the time, it seems a lot more scary than that, but it's a blip that was an opportunity,
Yeah, no, absolutely, Justin. And, you've heard me say many times, I've always been focused on the strategy that we've had for the business. I've continued to do that. As I said, in the deepest, darkest days, I've put my money where my mouth is. As of other directors, and look, the assets haven't changed, Justin. In fact, if anything, they've got better. We've continued to de-risk them. We've got permits to do work. That hasn't changed. So, the opportunity, the value opportunity is there today. And, good luck for those who are in a position to be able to take advantage of that opportunity.
Marvellous stuff. Tony, it's good to chat to you as always. And like you said, lots going on. So hopefully we'll catch up in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
All right, good on you, Justin. Always good to have a chat. Thanks for your time. Bye-bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Neil Ricketts, Chief Executive Officer of Vasarion. VRS is ticker there. Neil, thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Justin. Always a pleasure, as you know.
Yeah, and you've got some more news out, again, featuring 2D Tech. It's been awarded a grant from the Advanced Propulsion Centre. Now, first of all, take us through 2D Tech, and then we go into Advanced Propulsion, because it's different parts of Vasarion. I know 2D Tech deals with graphene and the very exciting substances and commodities and all that. So take us through what's happening here, Neil, if you could.
Yeah, sure. So 2D Tech is our spin-out from the University of Manchester. We purchased it in 2014, and we're We kind of work very, very closely with the team at Manchester. We're based or have a laboratory based at the Graphene Engineering Innovation Centre, part of the University of Manchester campus. And we're looking at the exploitation of graphene and using all of the support that's available for us to bring this new type of technology forward.
Yeah, yeah. So graphene, I was stumbling there because I was thinking, how do you describe graphene? Is it a substance, a commodity? What is it?
Oh, so graphene is a material. It's always been there. And, it's a... if you think of exploding graphene or graphite that you find in a pencil,
yeah.
Down to its single layer of atoms, I mean, this is, millions of thickness of a human hair, that kind of technology. So what we do is we have a very cost-effective, very commercially suitable process for creating these very, very thin flakes that then we put into other materials. And that's exactly what this grant is for.
Yeah, listen, people know, looked about graphene, it's been talked about this wondrous material for so many years because it's got so many different applications. It's very strong, it's very light, it's conductivity. At the moment, what is, where are we with graphene as in commercialization? I mean, is it now commercial or is it produced on a commercial level? What's the score here?
So it's in its very, very early days. So graphene was first isolated in 2005 and things started to become more interesting around 2010 when the Nobel Prize was awarded. But people have known about graphene since the early 20s, and Cambridge University get a little bit upset because they did some of the precursor work for this. But what the guys did in 2005 was they actually proved in the real world that they could isolate and keep graphene stable. And they also came about with a way of being able to test its properties, which are quite exceptional and very different from the graphite that it comes from. Mm-hmm. So... It's early days, and what we're starting to see now is serious players. The Rolls-Royce announcement the other day was testament to that. That actually, if you think about the development of any technology as being a curve, you have an initial hype period where everybody talks about it, and it's very hard to actually deliver. And then it kind of settles down a little bit, and then it starts to come back up on itself. As it becomes proven to work in real world applications, which is what we're seeing now.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, well, let's talk about this then. So the grant from the Advanced Propulsion Centre, talk us through the significance. It's £104,000, but I'm assuming it's not the money that's significant here, is it?
No, there's a couple of different reasons why we believe this to be significant for the business. The first one is that it's our first success with the Advanced Propulsion Centre, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a second. But secondly, it enables us to have a platform to talk to the automotive industry. So the Rolls-Royce story was all about aerospace, and this story is all about the automotive, and APC is a joint organization from the UK government and the automotive manufacturers to look at facilitating new technology in the cleaner automotive future. So think about electric vehicles, low carbon vehicles. These are all the things that they're looking for technology in order to enable. And that's why they're funding, in our particular case, up to £104,000 worth of funding to be able to enable us to take the technology that we have that's been proven in other industries and to look at how that may be played out for UK government in the automotive industry.
Okay, so what do you have to do then? It says here it's a part of a phase 18-month process. So what will you be doing with them, along with them? What do you have to do?
So we're looking at, so this is a program. It's about looking at the marketing. It's looking at about the connections. So on our side, we obviously have the technology and the technologists that know about graphene. On the other side of the table, we have the people that know about the automotive industry. They've worked in the automotive industry. They know all the contacts and connections. They know the application. They know how to talk the same language as the engineers that are on these projects that are looking for new technology in automotive. So it's an encompassing and kind of all-inclusive process for us to be able to look at how we take our technology. And in this particular case, the focal point is about lightweighting and reducing the weight of those vehicles through the use of things like carbon fiber technology or graphene reinforced polymers to make a significant difference to the way that we manufacture cars in the future.
Yeah. So ideally, you'd hope to get some kind of contract with a big automotive company out of this, would you?
That's the way that we look at it. It's a way of us being able to talk. You know, we're still a relatively small team, Justin. So we have a lot of projects, a lot of collaborations on at the moment. Our team are, you know, stretched. And this is a way of being able to use other people and leveraging other people's facilities in order for us to do things in a simultaneous fashion rather than trying to wait for aerospace to be finished and then moving on to automotive. This is a way of us bringing in extra resources that are funded so we don't have to go back to our shareholders for funding and to be able to exploit a completely new sector that we may not have the experience in. This particular sector I know quite well. I know some of the players in there and we supply some of those players through our AAC Kairoma facility. But you can never have enough people in your organization for all of the opportunities that we have in front of us.
Mm-hmm. Marvelous stuff. Okay. And talking about lightweight stuff, I mean, it's coronavirus, COVID-19 around, pretty much, I think, about 80% of the world's aircraft are grounded at the moment. And, of course, if we get back to, I mean, at the moment, you know, how can you social distance on a plane? It's a very, you know, scary concept, really. But if we get back to normal there, I mean, and a lot of, we've had complaints from sort of climate change activists saying the government in this country shouldn't bail out, you know, airlines because they're going to change the way they are. And I suppose, like we talked about previously, if it can be more sort of climate, you know, friendly, the airline industry, then people wouldn't mind. And so they've got to be looking at things like graphene, haven't they, a lot, the aerospace industry. I mean, like I said, Rolls-Royce is doing it. I mean, is the industry as a whole doing that?
I think these kind of events, you know, whilst they're absolutely traumatic and devastating for communities, enable us to reflect on what we have been doing. And to a certain extent, we've been a little bit spoiled. You know, air travel has become very similar to taking a bus for, you know, people like myself. You know, I go to Spain for monthly meetings like it was going to London. And we've become a little bit spoiled around air travel. I remember, you know, I'm old enough to remember when air travel was a real privilege. You know, it was something that you didn't do. And I think now we have to reflect on what the effects of what we've been doing has had on the environment and us as individuals. And I think there will be a new. And I think almost every company at the moment is looking at what they have been doing and what it might look like in the future. You know, that I'm a great advocate for electric vehicles, and I love the way that that Tesla, you know, challenge existing manufacturing techniques. You know, their new Model Y has a massive casting in the middle of it, which other companies would just never have looked at before. Mm-hmm. And I think moving forward, we'll need those kind of developments in order for us to even consider things like air travel or you know, commuting in the way that we do. I really do believe that there could be a new world on the back of this really traumatic and challenging situation that we've been through.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, out of every sort of adversity comes opportunity in some way, doesn't it? And that's the way, you know, we evolve. Marvellous, Neil, as always, then, give us three quick reasons, bullet points, why someone should add Vesarion to their watch list, please.
Okay, so the first reason is our connections and contacts, including centres like the Advanced Propulsion Centre, set us aside from everybody else. We have a great links with the University of Manchester and the University of Cambridge, which are unique in this field. The second reason is that we are developing a technology which is now being exploited in multiple sectors. So within the last week, we've talked about aerospace and today we're talking about automotive, but these are big sectors to be involved with. And the third thing is that I'm still a big shareholder in the organization and the second largest now. And you can guarantee that my aims and ambitions are all aligned with those of our long-term holders.
Marvellous stuff. Good to chat to you, Neil, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Nick Lee, Director of Pirri Investments. PIRI is the ticker. Nick, thanks for joining me.
Well, great to be here, Justin.
Yeah, some decent results, Ed. You've got your final results for the year, 31st of October 2019, Of course, they're historical now, but worth looking at, and then also worth looking at the highlights and just the outlook there. So, first of all, take us through some of the highlights, if you could.
Yeah, so I think that, as you say, they are a very good set of results. Profits of almost, over 860,000, which is pretty good for a company of our size. A lot of that was driven by profits from the investment we had in Eco Atlantic. So that's been very good for the company, and it's really enabled us to have the funds available to focus now on the technology space. So all in all, a good base for what we want to do with the company going forward.
Yeah, and that's a good time in the oil, because no one saw that coming, really. It's a scary move in the oil price, isn't it?
It's
pivoted to tech now. So take us through some. You announced recently that investment in Buyme.
Buyme was really a lot of our tech investments are sort of quite pertinent for what's currently going on in the world. So Buyme is a good one, because that's a platform that uses artificial intelligence to really facilitate online grocery shopping. So it sort of links the user of an app with the retailer, and got quite an innovative way of delivery via what the company calls personal shoppers. So you can build the business, you don't need vans, you don't need warehouses. You can scale it incredibly easily, and it's fulfilling a real need at the moment. So that's very interesting. And then the other thing that has sort of developed recently is this whole sort of cyber crime, and that's gone up massively in recent months, principally due to everybody now working from home. Yeah. And so got a couple of businesses in the portfolio that deal with that. So one is Get Visibility, that I think I've talked about before, which really manages and arranges and classifies and protects what we sort of describe as unstructured data in an organization, so emails, PDFs, Word documents, things like that. Mm-hmm. So again, the protection element there is very sort of relevant for today. And then another very interesting company is called Novalea, which really does cyber security, but for medical devices. Mm. So, historically, it's been relatively easy if you want to hack into systems to do it via a medical device, pacemaker or something like that, when it's connected up to the hospital's network. And this company works on providing protection to stop that. So, pretty exciting stuff, given what we're all having to deal with at the moment, really.
Yeah, that's scary when you think of it, because the Internet of Things now, everything is connected, so everything is hackable, isn't it? And it's almost like closing those doors, making sure every device that is connected is secure, because you don't think of it. You don't think of being hacked through your fridge, if it's a bit of it.
And before you know it, you get, a threat of somebody saying, well, you pay me this ransom and otherwise, I'll destroy all your sort of IT and data that you've got on your system. So, and that's not a good thing, not a good place for a company to be in, really. Mm-hmm. So, one thing I would say if you look at our portfolio, it's pretty well positioned against the background of the sort of new COVID-19 world, really. A couple of the other things in the portfolio, things like War Ducks, which is a gaming business. Well, there's a lot more gaming that goes on, and that was the company that Tim Cook from Apple visited not so long ago and tweeted about how he thought the sort of the games they do there were so great. And then the other one, which is actually listed, VRE, which is... now we're all looking at, obviously, online and at home learning, so that's involved in that space, and also the sort of holding of conference calls and Zoom calls. The next sort of stage is probably to look at doing that more on a virtual reality basis. So you're on your Zoom call, but actually you're in a room and you can see the person you talk to sitting next to you. which is quite an interesting concept.
I saw that. I saw one of those kind of things, on Click, BBC Click recently. It was there, and the guy was kind of amazed by it. It just brought you more into the field that you're in a proper meeting, you know. And do you know what? Going virtual, even with Buy Me like that now, it's you know, going forward, like I say, the lockdown will be a phased lifting. And yeah. I don't think, and Sainsbury's said today, actually, that queuing will be here until pretty much a vaccine is discovered. And so if it's either you get in the queue, you know, and outside the shop for 2 yards apart, 2 metres apart, or you just go online, you know. So
and also, what's quite interesting with Buy Me is you've also got the, you know, put COVID-19 to one side, you've got the whole environmental benefit. You know, you might have one person that goes and does the shopping for five people using this system and does the delivery. Mm. So instead of five people going to the supermarket and driving their car and emitting CO2 and stuff, you know, you've only got one person doing that. So, you know, there was a lot of sort of positivity about this particular company, even absent the COVID-19 scenario.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. And so it's, you are, you know, like I said, you know what people think, this COVID-19, a lot of people just think it's a one-off, it's a snap back to reality, to where it was. But I think, the more this is happening, the more time goes on, we're all starting to realise it's a gradual change of our habits, you know, because, and sometimes it's a change for the better, you know, isn't it? So,
This has given an opportunity. Everybody is sort of reflecting on, you know, how they used to work. They've taken a bit of time out and, you know, we'll work out what's more important and what's, to be honest, more efficient as well. You know, it's not necessarily massively efficient for everybody to truck into an office every day.
Mm. Absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Okay, Nick, thanks for that. Thanks for the update, and hopefully we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, brilliant. Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com. You all right, Chris?
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Very good. Too busy though, my goodness, it's a big old corporate earnings Thursday around the world, but particularly here in the UK.
Yeah, but have you ever seen markets like this? It's crazy. We're on the edge of apparently a depression, and yet the markets are rallying, and the S&P is like 10% off its high, or 9% off its high, all-time high. And it's just, yesterday we had US GDP for Q1 came out, down 4.8%, the worst since the financial crisis. And then you had this sort of anecdotal sort of evidence that remdesivir from Gilead Sciences may be good in the treatment of people. It's an antiviral drug, may be good in the treatment for coronavirus. And yet it rallied on that. And so it ignored the economy and rallied on. But I just find it crazy. I understand the Fed is pumping. They're buying, you know, they're increasing their assets. But how long can this bounce? I see it as a bounce. I see it grinding lower, because I did do a video a while back saying we'll have this euphoria when the deaths go down and the lockdown starts to happen. We'll have this euphoria, initial euphoria. Then the economic financial fallout will start to happen. I think it'll grind lower. But it's a heck of a bounce, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, what's that old saying about markets? Markets can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent. Yeah. And I guess it's a good thing, unless you're desperately aggressively short, that for most people that markets are pushing up on a sort of an anticipatory kind of cycle. The funny thing is, though, I described it earlier in the week as climbing a wall of worry. Mm. And, you know, we've seen this before in markets. If you go back, certainly if you've had, a couple of decades plus in markets like me, you've seen it before and it happens. But ultimately, you can travel, but you ultimately arrive. And we all know that fundamentals ultimately matter. So I think at this moment in time, you know, the influence of central banks and governments is big. I think the reality, the arrival point will come when we start seeing widespread sort of lockdown loosenings. And we're clearly close to that moment now in influential kind of economies from a Western world perspective, you know, Europe and America, and obviously our own economy. So I think we've got that clearly more tricky transitional period to go through. And unless you start seeing some progress with either, you know, there being overtly no second wave, or some progress on the clinical front. As you say, people jumped on a product which, you know, doesn't cure you of coronavirus. It just helps sort of mean you're less likely to be desperately ill in hospital, apparently, allegedly. You know, we don't really know is the answer. So we sort of got all these weird things happening, money sloshing around the system, a bit of hope, a bit of traveling rather than arriving. It's if you like, the corollary to the, you know, absolutely massive and phenomenal falls of February into March, really. So markets, you know, never totally logical, always excitable and volatile. I guess we'd have it no other way.
Yeah, I don't think there's ever been a V like this that has gone so far down and so far back up. You know, it's phenomenal, so aggressive. And like I said, the sell-off was scary, and now this is. I'm largely in sort of cash, really. So I'm thinking this can't continue. I mean, I'm benefiting from it because I still hold about 40% in equity, but about 60% in cash. So so I would like to be more in equities, but I'm starting to think this will roll over sooner or later. It's almost like the stock market is having a V-shaped recovery, but the economy probably won't, you know?
Yeah, but the thing, we know the market looks forward, and it's a difficult one because you've got the money sloshing around the system. We know that if money sloshes around the system, then valuations can go up, and it may also create inflation, which also can push up nominal share prices. So there's that sort of aspect. There's the fundamental aspect, which is, oh my goodness, you know, what is corporate profitability going to be like? How long will it take to bounce back to the levels of full year 2019, let alone what it actually is in reality this year, next year, etc. So there's lots of puts and takes. It's tricky. All I would say, and you know, you and I have talked about this before, the key is number one, the investments that you're making, is that company solvent, and is it a survivor, right, under most reasonable circumstances? Has it got time to sort of work through these issues? And number two, are they going to come out of it ultimately being in a better position with a better market share and the ability to generate cash over the medium term? And that are the sort of things you can grab hold onto and say, okay, ultimately, what would I value these things on? Because I guess for many people, sure, some people are trying to trade this week and next week. Other people are trying to trade or trying to think about it from the investment perspective of a number of years, perhaps until some big event in their lives, their retirement, they're saving for something else or whatever. And from that perspective, you can get still excited about markets because, and it's amazing to say, every single crash that I've seen from 87 onwards, if you look on a long enough term chart, they're just blips. And even though the coronavirus is clearly something extraordinary, you know, a very distressing and clearly massively impactful just because of what it is, we will get past this. You know, that is the positive human ingenuity aspect and insight. So, yeah, just make sure that you're there when the world is kind of getting back to normal. And from an investment perspective, that means investing in companies which are solvent and survivors, because there's nothing worse than seeing all the opportunities at some future point and not having the cash to invest in them.
Yeah, no, I've got the cash, but the trouble is it's bounced too quickly for me. It's give me a chance to scale in. It's like, it was like a whipsawed. But anyway, let's talk about some individual companies. Chris, I'm talking about cash. I see Royal Dutch Shell breaking with the tradition there.
That's right. Royal Dutch Shell, they've announced that their first dividend cut since the World War II period. So this is obviously striking, historical and everything else. Put a couple of numbers on it. They pay a quarterly dividend. You know, they're sort of old-fashioned in that sense. And they quote it in dollars and cents because obviously oil is a dollar-denominated entity. So they've come down from sort of a quarterly dividend in the upper 40s to 16 cents a share. So, you know, clearly that's material cut. And the reason they've done that is literally because of two things. Number one is we all know that the coronavirus is impacting business disruption, impacts on economic growth and everything. And clearly that impacts oil and oil demand. The second aspect is, of course, that the oil market is in crisis at the moment. We've had that crazy negative oil price situation on some futures contracts a few weeks ago. But clearly oil prices have have come down materially. You put all those things together, even for a big integrated operator rolled out Shell, this is an absolute shocker. Profits under huge pressure, and gearing and borrowings going up. And so they've decided to slash their dividend, mainly because they want to make sure that their borrowing levels don't get too much out of control. So I think a sensible move, in my perspective, from a sort of a prudence perspective, by my reckoning, the dividend yield going forward is going to be around about 3.6-3.7%, which in normal times is far from shabby. You know, most income investors would be quite happy with that, particularly when interest rates are the square root of zero at the moment. But the thing is, of course, it's a shock at the margin. The shares were down when I last looked 7%+. You've got to put this slightly into context. They've had a decent run in recent weeks, obviously having, you know, themselves suffered big falls over the last year or two with the slow decline in the oil price and everything else. So it's some puts and takes. I think for longer term investors, people who want to invest in Shell as a viable, solvent, sensible oil and gas company, they'll accept this as you know, part of making sure that they are sustainable. Of course, income investors at the margin will be disappointed, but I'm afraid they've got to see the bigger picture here, and that's the important thing. So,
yeah. Well, do you know what? I've always found it a bit odd that you know, they've always said that we haven't cut the dividend since World War II, and regardless, I mean, first and foremost, it's probably a nice track record to have, but you shouldn't just pay a dividend because you've always paid one. You know, the finances come first, don't they? And that's the trouble. You can't just skint the company because it's a tradition. You've always paid the dividend. No, I mean, that's a sensible thing to do, I think, and it really is.
It is. I mean, look, we all know that what's the stats about reinvested dividends being sort of 80% of a stock's longer term returns, and we all get the reason why that is. You know, there's a bit of maths and a bit of survivorship bias in there, but reinvested dividends is a great route to making money over the longer haul, because you know, it's money on money, basically. And if you're buying into a rising and growing company, that's a great thing. And clearly there's the income aspect too. But yeah, with shares, I always think about them on a total return perspective. And, you know, from that perspective, I think personally, the integrated oil and gas space has been one that I've been struggling with for a year or two, frankly. I haven't held investments in things like Shell or BP or akin names for a long time. And that's not because, you know, I don't want dividend income or related. It's because actually, if you look at the longer term valuation here, it's centered on the oil and gas commodity, which is under some pressure from things such as climate change and related, and the value of those assets. So for me, I personally am not particularly attracted to them. You know, whether they've cut the dividend or not, I think it's a sensible move, but as an investment, I'm not buying them even here, mainly because I worry that they're going to be forced to diversify into other areas which are going to be less remunerative than classic oil and gas production. So for me, I'm still struggling on the total return story on names such as Shell.
Yeah, and they did say, you know, the macro outlook, it's a continued deterioration in that outlook. So what's out there? Other companies out today, Chris, what's there?
Yeah, we've got to talk a bit about Lloyds Bank. I mean, Lloyds Bank is obviously they were forced to sort of suppress, you know, eliminate their dividend by the government and the regulators a few weeks back. So no surprises on the dividend, or no new surprises on the dividend front from them today. They've come up with a quarter one statement. It looks messy, and the shares were down about 3%+, 3-4% when I last looked. It looks messy because they've taken a $1.4 billion impairment charge. You've guessed it. It's because of the coronavirus and everything else. But what's really interesting is two things with Lloyds. Lloyds has always been perceived as the most boring and straightforward of the high street banks, and that's because a lot of their business is things such as mortgages, which in terms of financial products is a bit more straightforward than some highfalutin investment banking or something like that, or corporate lending or whatever it might be. So Lloyds has always been perceived as a little bit less sort of risky from the sort of compared to things such as RBS or Barclays with their investment bank and stuff like that. the but looking into the detail today, and they gave quite a lot of detail. It's in that sense, I think they've learned from previous cycles and times when, you know, they perhaps were a bit more opaque. I think it's good to give detail. This is what you should be doing with investors at stressful times. If you look at the $1.4 billion impairment they took, kind of interesting, 25% of it they would have taken in any case, because as always with banks, you get bad debts and issues and stuff like that. The rest of the impairment is kind of coronavirus linked, but actually the majority of it is linked to slower economic growth. And this is the thing with a bank is always a geared play on an economy, because guess what, when growth slows down, things such as bank lending, it more of it goes wrong, and things like that happen. And so what they've said today is their base scenario is that, and this is what's led to the majority of the new impairment today, is a 5% contraction in UK growth this year and a 3% bounce back next year. That's their core scenario. Mm-hmm. If it's worse than that, and by that I assume they're saying the contraction is more than 5% over full year 2020 and the bounce back is less than 3% in 2021, then they could be a further 2 billion basically of impairments. So, you know, looking at the numbers and everything, they do have the balance sheet to withstand that, all other things being equal, but clearly it's risky and it's geared. And so my feelings on the banks are that, you know, they are geared plays on the economy. If you're kind of a glass half full person, if you think that the UK is actually going to be all right, we are going to grow much better next year, we are going to have some element of a V-shaped sort of recovery type thing, then the banks are a good investment here, you know. And something like a Lloyds is at the core of that. You know, we'll see, RBS are out tomorrow, Barclays came out earlier in the week. You know, you can make a play for these things are cheap versus book value, but you've got to believe in that book value. Personally, I think there is a role for financials here. I think, you know, you can find some interesting plays. Certainly, I'd prefer them more to the oil companies, given a choice between the two. But you're not going to get any dividend short term from them. That's a certainty.
I bought a little bit of HSBC, and I thought historically, do you know what? And I it's so complicated to look at their balance sheets and all that stuff, and there's so much stuff going on there, you know. But I just thought, I looked at the chart, and I thought, I don't know, you know, China and all that Far East seem to be sort of coming out of it a lot faster than the West. I mean, and I think it's just a historic low, and I'll start scaling in maybe. But I don't know if I've lost my enthusiasm about banks now. But I'm up a little bit, because I got in about just around about £4, and it's now £4.30. But I don't know, shall I hold for a long time, or I don't know, I'm just not sure about it. I don't know how deep this recession is going to be, you know?
You see, HSBC is a different beast. I purposely didn't mention them, because historically you would have done, right? Because Midland Bank, which obviously they own and still own, was a huge part of their business. But far less so today, you know, less than 10% of their business. Their big play is, unsurprisingly, as you know, actually the name would suggest, Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation, is Hong Kong and China. Mm. And so, you know, if your case for HSBC, I think, is more of a, do you believe that they will be able to lend money and do financial services and related in a profitable and growing manner within the Greater China arena or not? And I think that's a different play. I wouldn't actually disagree with that concept. HSBC is also quite a prudent bank. It always has been the one which where loans and assets are much more sort of evenly balanced. You know, most banks, if you go in there, if every depositor went in there and said, "I want my money back," you know, they wouldn't be able to have it, because the bank lends out a multiple or more than 100% of those deposits. HSBC has always been much more balanced. So I think HSBC's got a couple of different angles to it because of its geographic orientation and relative prudence. So personally, I think, you know, that was quite a wise call by you. And I think I would be holding on to that one as a sort of a core banking position for the medium term.
Yeah, maybe I will. Okay, you've convinced me. I'll see.
They cut the dividend too, though. You know, HSBC cut their dividend as well. So, you know, you're not unfortunately going to get massive income. But, you know, it's I think the total return game is not too bad.
Yeah, at the moment, I'm just looking at 3-year horizons. I'm just thinking, is this likely to be higher in 3 years? And I think the probability is quite high, I think, of it will be higher in 3. Otherwise, we'll go through some disastrous times if it doesn't get higher in 3 years' time than we are now, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's certainly true. You look at, it's interesting, like we just talked about the UK profile. So Lloyds are thinking the UK market, the UK economy, sorry, is going to contract by 5% this year and grow 3% next year. Now, if you look at China, the Chinese government, all right, you know, all health warnings are, you know, adjusted for that. The Chinese government still think that the Chinese economy is going to grow this year, 1% or 2%. Right, and next year it's going to grow somewhat better than that, and so that is a sort of a different sort of profile. And so if you're a bit more exposed to that, and you know, we see it in other companies that have, you know, we've talked before about things like Burberry, for example, with their 30%+ of sales to China, and other groups, you know, Prudential with obviously their big insurance exposure to the Asian region. You know, that's a different sort of profile, which certainly I think when you're thinking about putting together a portfolio, good to look into where your companies geographically are focused. My feeling is having a decent slug towards companies with Asia emerging market exposure is, over that sort of time scale, you know, the wise and smart thing to do. So, you know, I think that kind of works.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I think it's quite funny how I think the profits dropped, yeah, that's it, 48%. This is for Q1, was it? Oh, no, for 3 months of March, yeah, they dropped 48% their profits to $3.2 billion for the first quarter. Then you imagine your profits dropping by half, pretty much, but you're still making $3.2 billion. That's a lot of money, isn't it? You know.
Yeah, no, it's obviously always in the context of the size of the company, and you know, they can have other impairments and whatever else, but. Indeed, they're not going bust, I think you can safely say.
Yeah, cool. Anything else, Chris, out there?
Quick one on Reckitt Benckiser. Reckitt's, as I'm sure many listeners know, have a bunch of health and hygiene products. The fact that they own things such as Dettol and Silit Bang and whatever else, clearly a lot of these products have been very much in favour over recent weeks and months for all very obvious reasons. Yeah. They had a stonking quarter one in terms of their like-for-like sales growth. I think it was up 13% on one measure. And, you know, what they've said today is it's quite a funny statement. They've sort of said, yeah, you know, we'll give a proper full-year view at the next, the half-year point. But, you know, there's a deep hint that basically they'll be raising their targets because obviously, you know, it's a positive for them. And even though there will be a little bit of downdraft, you know, maybe you've got enough Silit Bang or Dettol products already, there might be a little bit more of a slowdown in upcoming months and quarters. Clearly, there's been a phenomenal period, trading period for them, particularly as they were coming off some quite easy comps. I think we touched on Reckitt Benckiser a week or two ago when I was talking about PZ Cousins. And I said, for those looking in the FTSE 100, Reckitt's was kind of an interesting play, not just because it was benefiting because of its products, but there's a turnaround there as well. There's a newish CEO. My feeling is over time they will look to demerge the health and the hygiene businesses, which I think will give it, you know, a bit more kind of focus, you know, the classic sort of spin-off entrepreneurial thing. So Reckitt shares, I think, up 3-4% when I last looked today, and you can understand why. I mean, sadly, they are beneficiaries, you know, big brands in the right places.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Thanks for that, Chris. And we'll see what... we've got more initial jobless claims from the US out later, and probably up to 30 million by now, but it doesn't matter. The stock market will go higher.
That's right. The Federal Reserve is still printing money, and the Donald is optimistic, so obviously he's always
right.
He's
got to be, isn't he? He's got to be. You know, he's got an election coming up.
He's got an election to win, indeed.
Yeah. Marvellous. Cheers, Chris.
No problem. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.